Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms both in the system and within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Paul Stamets. Paul Stamets is a mushroom researcher and admirer. He's president of Fungi Perfecte, a mail-order business supplying cultures, equipment, and mycotechnologies to mushroom cultivators throughout the world. He's discovered four new species of mushrooms and pioneered countless techniques in the field of edible and medicinal mushrooms, cultivation, and in fungal bioremediation. He's written five books, including Growing Gourmet and Medicinal Mushrooms, The Mushroom Cultivator, Psilocybin Mushrooms of the World, and many articles and scholarly papers. He hikes and spends a lot of time in the forest, lives in Washington State, and is now got 16 patents pending, and a book coming out soon called Mycelium Running. So we're going to be talking about all those things. And since I met Paul Stamets a couple years ago at Bioneers, which is where we are now, and was just so taken with your work and so encouraged by the incredible things that mushrooms can do, like changing toxic waste into something benign very quickly. So I know you're really busy, and I'm really, really happy that you found time to talk to me, Paul Stamets. I'm interested to know what new things are happening. And I also want to say that mushrooms have become a bigger and bigger thing in my own personal life, as I have access to lots of wonderful mushrooms at the Berkeley Farmers Market. And I eat mushrooms every day because they're like, just know they're so good for me. So tell us more.
Well, thank you, Sue. It's a pleasure to be here. And I know it may seem rather extraordinary. I have 16 patents. Actually, there's 17 patents that I've filed for. My first patent was awarded in December of 2003. There's actually six or seven major patents, and the rest of them are divisionals. Divisionals are basically sub-patents within your first patent. And the analogy that I make is like, for those people who don't understand how these patents and the patent law works, is if you invented the wheel on a unicycle, for instance, and you're the inventor of the wheel, per se, as an example, then within 1 year, you can create derivative, obvious patents that are derivative ideas of your first patent. So the analogy would be then if you use the wheel for the bicycle and the tricycle and the automobile, those would be sub-patents that would be derivative from your original idea. So the patents are big picture patents, and I'm really honored and delighted and respectful of nature, because nature is really the ultimate creator of these ideas, and I'm just the communicator. But the importance of filing these patents is such that we can have the greatest environmentally positive impact and get these large corporations to truly be sustainable. And by filing these patents, I get the big people, the big boys and ladies at the table. And so these patents are very important for habitat restoration. My first patents could replace most of the chemical pesticides throughout the world. It's a huge home run for me, and I'm really honored that I am the person who is the communicator. Through thousands of years, there's been a thin thread of knowledge that has passed down the information on how to use mushrooms and mushroom mycelium, and this ancestral knowledge largely has been lost. It survives now only because of my teachers and of my ancestors who have carried the torch and have passed it. And it's been long said by many people that every time an elder dies, we lose an entire library, and that's so true, because the information on the historical use of fungi has been largely lost, and most people are unaware of the importance of mushrooms. You know, 10,000, 15,000 years ago, we were forest people. We lived in the woods. We were nomads, and we traveled following herds of animals, and we were hunters and gatherers. And being in intimate contact with the forest fungi was absolutely instrumental for our survival. The famous Iceman, for instance, that was found in the fall of 1991 on the border of Austria and Italy, he had tethered to his right side three mushrooms, two polypore mushrooms One's called the birch polypore, Piptoporus betulinus, and the other one was called I call it the Iceman polypore, Fomes fomentarius. But the Fomes fomentarius is a birch. These are woodconk shell fungi. They're really hard. They're largely inedible in the classic sense. Most Aboriginal peoples would not even recognize these or call these with the nomenclature of mushrooms, being called tree biscuits, tree warts, etc., because they're not soft and fleshy. They're as hard as wood. But the Iceman had several of these mushrooms with him because they were extremely important for human survival. And there's no doubt that we all migrated out of Africa. We are all Africans at heart. And as we migrated north into Europe, we encountered something new and unusual called winter. And if our clan could not keep fire alive, then we would die. And the polypore mushroom, this one, Fomes fomentarius, is called the tinder mushroom also. You can hollow it out after it's been dried, and you can pack embers of a fire into the mushroom, and it makes fire portable. So the portability of fire was absolutely critical for our clan's survival as we migrated into northern climates. This is just one of many, many examples. This tinder mushroom also, when you boil it in water, produces very strong antimicrobial properties. My work with Battelle Laboratories proved that it has strong anti-E. coli properties. And as you can imagine, the souring of meat would be a cause of disease, and E. coli is one of the pathogens against mushrooms and a pathogen against us. It's interesting that we share in common many of the microbial pathogens that mushrooms also suffer from. And so the antibiotics that mushrooms produce and fungi produce also are effective against the bacteria, which are pathogenic to us. This story gets very, very interesting and complex, and the more I study the subject, the more I realize how instrumental mushrooms are to our very existence.
It seems to me I heard you once say that mushrooms and humans were related, and you're kind of referring to that now.
Yeah. It's estimated now that 465 million years ago, we shared a common ancestry with fungi. As our proto-ancestors came from the ocean and hit the beach, you know, that's when we diverged. And the fungi chose the route of externally digesting its nutrients. These are filamentous cells, single cells, that are form this fine cobwebby material, which we call mycelium. We went the route of encapsulating our nutrients by encircling the food and producing enzymes and acids and created more or less of a proto-stomach. And that's when we diverged from fungi about 465 million years ago. And then as organisms started to proliferate on land, the protection of the cells from moisture loss became critical. And so we developed skin layers. We have 5, 6, 7 skin layers now. And the mushroom mycelium still only has one. And yet it's in direct contact with incredibly complex microbial populations, literally numbering into the hundreds of millions of organisms per gram of soil. And yet the mycelium only has one cell wall or skin layer that protects them from outside pathogens. How does it do that? How is it able to protect itself from other pathogenic organisms from invading? And I believe that these membranes, these cellular membranes, are exquisitely well adapted. They've been around longer than we have. Around 250 million years ago, at the boundary of the Permian and the Triassic period, a giant cataclysmic event wiped out over 90% of the species on this planet. And it's thought to be a giant meteorite. And when it hit the Earth, and it caused the Earth to darken, and there was no sunlight for many, many years. It's not really clear how many years. But that really began the dawn of fungi. The fungi then surged and took over the Earth, so to speak. Huge debris fields were created. Plants and animals died back, and the fungi requiring no light, and plants requiring light, of course, the fungi surged and the plants declined. That then was the age of mycelium, so to speak. And then as that progressed until the next giant cataclysmic meteorite strike around 65 million years ago, caused a similar collapse of the ecosystem, and then fungi then resurged. A very interesting number of amber fossils have been found of mushrooms fully intact within amber resin. And these go back from 10 million to now the oldest one, 90 million years ago. So before we were even little voles, many of these mushrooms have actually developed into the recognizable cap, stem, gills, produce spores. And so these are ancestral organisms. They've been around longer than we have. What's interesting about the mushroom mycelium is they can achieve masses greater than that of any other organism yet found on this planet. The largest organism in the world is the mycelial mat in eastern Oregon. It's over 2,000 acres in size, over 2,200 years old. It's this honey mushroom in the genus Armillaria, and it is a parasitic fungus that kills trees and kills the forest. But it's killed the forest in eastern Oregon, the old-growth forest there, at least four times over, maybe more. And every time it collapses an ecosystem, the debris from the trees, the dead trees, is being saprophytized by the mycelium, and the soil is being created. So actually you have increased soil depth with each succession of these old-growth forests that are then climaxed by these fungi. And the increased soil depth leads to increased carrying capacity, increased sustainability, more complex of a biosphere, a greater proliferation of organisms. And so, in fact, these are keystone species that lead to the increasing complexity of the genome. And I believe that the complexity of the genome is specifically related to the host defense of our environment and being able to prevent disease vectors. And the host defense that we need for our immune system, I believe habitats also have an immune system. And these fungi are actually critical as gatekeepers in being able to steer the course of ecological evolution to greater complexity. And why not? Because they would produce more trees that would give more substrate for their progeny. And in doing so, they condition the environment with a long-term view in mind. We suffer from a form of ecological myopia in that we look at the environments in just a very short, limited lifespan. What can we get in our lifespan? And to the credit of First Peoples, and especially Native Americans, the concept of seven generations is absolutely point specific to the view that modern peoples need to really adopt as part of our operating program. We need to look downstream, as the fungi do, you know, thousands of years into the future. And us now losing habitats, losing genomic complexity, we are going to cross in the future, and I'm not sure where. We might be at it right now. Some people think so. But at some threshold below which we cross in terms of biological complexity, we may enter into a new sphere of devolution where the ecosystems could collapse with incredible rapidity as the ecosystems try to readapt. And the debris fields that we are creating fuel these fungal life cycles, but we're upsetting the balance. And if we overload the carbon cycles and we cannot recycle the carbon back into the food chain quick enough, then we're going to imbalance and destabilize the ecosystem. We will lose equilibrium. And in doing so, then the rule of nature is when an organism exceeds the carrying capacity of its environment, diseases proliferate. And so we may be the ultimate disease organism, and the diseases that we're facing today, from HIV to Ebola to all these other pathogenic bacteria that are evolving in hospitals because of the use of antibiotics, is a game that we will ultimately lose unless we come to a new understanding of how to live in balance with our environment.
Yep. Well, I agree. That's clear. And it seems that mushrooms can do so many positive things. I remember you're talking about how they can transform toxic waste into non-toxicity in a very short time. That is just so amazing, and I'm sure you have a lot of new things to tell about the wonders of mushrooms.
Well, I mean, in the theater of experimentation, the wonderful thing about nature as the inventor is nature's had, you know, billions of years of experimentation. You know, we are just new inventors, you know, just really in the past two or three centuries. We've started finding different tools to help us survive in the environment as we've clustered in the cities and we've had growing food in remote locations and transportation systems, et cetera, et cetera. The way the best, I think, to explain how mushrooms and mushroom mycelium can break down toxic waste is to understand how they operate within the ecosystem. The mycelium is only one cell thick in this membrane, and it exudes enormous amounts of enzymes and acids and antibiotics. And the enzymes, specifically manganese peroxidase, which is a lignine peroxidase and cellulases, break down lignine and cellulose, the two primary components in plants. These are the two primary fibrous components in plants. And they break hydrogen-carbon bonds, and that holds lignine and cellulose together. Well, those hydrogen-carbon bonds that are so exquisitely broken down by mushroom mycelium, which cannot be broken down virtually by any other organism or group of organisms on the planet, that well at least, is also the same bonds that are held in common with hydrocarbon-based contaminants. Petroleum products and oil products, and as well as pesticides and PCBs, are all held tightly together by the same hydrogen-carbon bond, and the enzymes unweave and break apart that bond, and the mycelium are the grand molecular decomposers. They demolecularize large complexes of plant molecules into simpler forms, and oftentimes elemental forms, that are then re-uptake into the mycelium and then remanufactured into carbohydrates or chitinous-like materials. And so this sort of path of breaking down wood ultimately leads to soil. And the path of decomposition, there is the enormous number of spin-offs of other byproducts that fuel insect life cycles, as well as plant life cycles, as well as mammal life cycles, et cetera, as food. This dance between these kingdoms is something that nature has devised over time, which leads to ultimate sustainability. And that's where we are today, is trying to understand how we can create systems that nature has already devised and how we can adapt those with our burgeoning population and our stressing of resources in the environment.
You said, Paul Stamets, in the beginning of the interview that mushrooms can replace most or all pesticides.
Well, I'm not sure about all, but I'm fairly optimistic about most. The patent that I have and the one, the divisionals, and I expect we'd have about a dozen more divisional patents being issued here in the next 2 years, is from my observation that many, many insects are parasitized by fungi. And the pesticide industry, with the encouragement of the EPA, and the EPA gets enormous amounts of credit, the environmental movement gets enormous amounts of credit for recognizing the fact that pesticides such as DDT and other very toxic pesticides have collateral damage against a lot of other non-targeted organisms. And these toxins that are neurologically damaging to insects are also neurologically damning to us. Insects are actually animals. They're invertebrates, but, you know, we are in the same kingdom. And I believe always that the war against nature is a war against our own biology. And so if you have a toxin that is going to kill an insect, you have to be very careful that it doesn't also kill you. And there's a big belief now amongst neurologists that a big coefficient factor in causing neurological dementia and Alzheimer's, and MS, Parkinson's disease, and premature senility, et cetera, may have a cofactor in the exposure to pesticides. Our parents' generation, it was better living through chemistry. And I don't think anybody in our parents' generation really anticipated creating toxins that would cause cancer. They were trying to solve problems, and they didn't understand that there's lots of other ancillary negative effects from the production of these toxins. The nature-based systems, which we call mycopesticides, is using fungi that naturally parasitize insects. And the EPA got very excited about this in the 1980s and 1990s. Many of the big pesticide companies, Dow and Monsanto, DuPont, you know, all the big pesticide players, got real excited as well, and they started looking at biopesticides, and I call mycopesticides, those that which use fungi, as a way of being able to replace chemical pesticides. And so the numerous patents were issued, and the spores, when they were made in contact with these insects, the spores would germinate, and they would actually produce a hyphal peg that would penetrate through the exoskeleton and burrow. The mycelium would burrow directly into the interior flesh of the insects and then grow, and it would kill the insect. Well, the biopesticides at first were ballyhooed as being the great salvation for replacing chemical pesticides, but encountered some immediate hurdles. Number one, the insects aren't stupid. They can smell a pathogen quite remote from contact, and they avoid it. Why wouldn't they? We open up the refrigerator when there's moldy bread. We have an aversion to it. Well, the insects are much more sensitive than we are to these type of olfactory responses. And so even though in the petri dish in the laboratory they could dust the insects with spores of these fungi and kill the insects, when they made bait stations to go outside, the insects would approach the bait stations and then turn tail and run. And my big epiphany, and I discovered this because my house, which was badly decomposing and being eaten by carpenter ants, I ordered some of these cultures which the EPA approved, and I started playing around with them. And I thought to myself, well, if the insects know that these mold fungi are plague organisms and they have such a strong aversion I had the epiphany that after hundreds of millions of years of evolution, that the mycelium would know that the insects know. And that was my kind of big breakthrough. So I was able to morph the cultures into a pre-sporulating state, opening up a mycelial window. And sure enough, I hit the big home run. And we have now isolated what we call super attractants. These attractants from the entomopathogenic fungi, the fungi that kill the bugs prior to sporulation, produce these suites of aromas and fragrances that are incredibly enticing to the intended victims. And it's an alternative path that the fungi, I think, have evolved such that if they couldn't make contact via spores, they can entice the bugs to come and pick up the mycelium and move it. So these social insects use queens in their colonies, and they're called factory fortresses. They're actually warrior guards that stand at the entrances of these giant queen-based colonies. And if any workers come through that are carrying spores of a pathogen, they're prevented entry. So there's tremendous amounts of grooming, and the guards protect the nest. Well, so if you couldn't get to the queen, then you could not treat the insect problem. So with the mycelium, we have found in numerous studies at Texas A&M University, and now it's been corroborated by numerous other laboratories, that when we take that same culture that would be producing spores and we delay sporulation, then the workers pick up the mycelium as fragments and they go right past the guards, and it's actually queen-friendly. They present it to the queen. The queen distributes it to the brood. And in turn, the entire nest becomes inoculated with fragments of mycelium. So the workers actually are working for you, spreading a pathogen. It's a big insect party for about a week. Everybody loves it. And then suddenly, whoosh, the entire colony connects with mycelium, and the entire colony suddenly dies. And so because then, after the colony dies, it sporulates, then it prevents future invasions into that locality. And so it has a preventive property preventing future invasions. And as a result, it is target specific to the colony, and it does not release a plague into nature because this is a naturally occurring organism literally in the soil that upon which all these insects are walking.
Wow. Well, I'm not sure I followed absolutely everything you said, Paul Stamets, but I sure am impressed when I hear about fine-tuned stuff that goes on in nature that we humans, westernized humans anyway, pay so little attention to so often. We don't have a lot of time left, and I want to say for one thing, we were talking about patents in the beginning. It took a while for me to remember, ooh, I usually don't like this patenting of plants and human genes and all these kind of things. So I'm glad it's you.
Well, I'm glad it's one of us. Let me put it that way. You know, it's time for us, for the environmentalists, to march to the forefront of business. I'm dealing with huge companies now, and sustainability is a very big issue with them. Over my patents, I have the guiding principles, which are strong environmental principles. Since we have such little time left, what has really come into focus to me is that nature is intelligent. I believe nature is aware. It is conscious of our being here. We are part of nature. We are not separate from nature. And if we have brains that can intellectualize, you know, how could we suspect that nature is not intelligent when nature gave us the very brains to conceive the concept? That's an oxymoron I don't think you can get over. So nature is intelligent, and I believe these membranes of mycelium is indeed Earth's natural internet. These are information-sharing networks that are extremely sophisticated in their models of biomolecular communication, and they are all around us. And we've come to the top of the food chain, so to speak, but in a sense, our ascension has exceeded our wisdom. And we ascended quickly to the top of the food chain without having sort of the operating language that we really need to be able to behave in a coherent and responsible manner.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to mention a couple things. One is that in my garden at home, I noticed different mushrooms just pop up, different years, different times, they pop up. They don't live too long, they or at least about the parts that I see, they go away, and that's really interesting. And also, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show here, I eat mushrooms all the time because there's this array of mushrooms to eat, which I know is nothing compared to the thousands of species of mushrooms there are. But there's a bunch at the Berkeley Farmers Market, and they're all good for me, and they're delicious, so why not?
The presence of mushrooms in your environment is a sign of the environment responding to different debris fields, and they're coming out of the fabric of nature because they're recycling. So you should always, I always express joy every time I see a mushroom pop out of the environment. I know that the environment is healthy, it's recycling, it's providing nutrients to plants, and they're very important as allies, and they're really our friends, and we need to understand them better. And the beautiful thing about these mushrooms is that they grow quickly. And so they're very responsive. In terms of a new biotechnologies, I know of no other biotechnology that can cover such great landscapes in such a quick period of time and do so much. And so I'm an actually impatient person. This is the way I am. And I'm really glad that I have fungal allies that also respond very quickly to catastrophia in a very short period of time.
Really? So do you want to let us know a little bit more very quickly about your upcoming book, Mycelium Running?
Right. Mycelium Running is my seminal book. This is book number 6 for me. 10-Speed Press in Berserkly is the publisher. I'm greatly honored that they are. The title of the book is Mycelium Running, and it is planetary healing through growing medicinal mushrooms. And it's a very simple techniques. There's no laboratory techniques in the book. It's all about natural harvesting of spawn from wild patches of mushrooms or using mushrooms that you actually collect. And it's very important methods for habitat restoration, for breaking down toxic waste, for mycofiltration. I've sort of invented a new science, which I call mycorestoration. And the mycorestoration is using mycelium, and there's 4 subcategories. There is mycoremediation, breaking down of toxic waste, mycofiltration, screening out of bacterial pathogens, mycoforestry, which is the co-cultivation of fungi with plants, including trees, and then mycopesticides. And this book is really about mycorestoration, but it's how to engage fungal allies to help the planet.
Fantastic. Okay, well, we'll look for this book, Mycelium Running. You can go to Paul Stamets' website, www.fungi.com, and you can look at his other books. And thank you so much for this interview, Paul Stamets.
Great. Well, thank you, Sue. I'm glad we could do it.
My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening. To hear other programs produced by Sue Supriano, go to my website at www.suesupriano.com. Sue Supriano is spelled SueSupriano. And to order copies of my shows, you can send me an email at sue@suesupriano.com, or you can call me at 510-883-1979. Again, that's sue@suesupriano.com is the email, and the telephone is 510-883-1979.